नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा संबुद्धस्स नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा संबुद्धस्स नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा संबुद्धस्स बुद्धं धम्मं संघं नमस्सामि। So we began the retreat just over a week ago, Friday evening, and now we're on Saturday evening, a week later. And very interesting to notice just how the days just seem to kind of slip by. At least that's been my experience. Sometimes on retreat the first few days go a bit more slowly. That bits of them sometimes seem extraordinarily permanent. And then after about the first 3 or 4 days, suddenly it just kind of slips away. And before we know it, it's the end. Sometimes coming towards the end of a retreat, there can be a slightly panicky feeling. You know, for different reasons, we might be aware that there's only another few hours to go, and we're not quite enlightened yet. You know, having begun the retreat with tremendous hopes and aspirations, even if they weren't totally conscious, there's a slight feeling that by the end of the retreat, at least there'd be a feeling that we'd made some progress. Even if we weren't quite enlightened, at least a feeling that we were significantly further along the way, having put in plenty of effort than we were at the beginning. And so we get to day 7 or 8 or 9 and feeling of, oh, well, I haven't got very far. Haven't got as far as I hoped, and there's only a few more hours, and then it'll be the end, and then my chances of getting enlightened are significantly diminished when I go back to my everyday life. And you know, I don't know when I'm going to get on another retreat again, have another crack at it, and so it can go like that. Those of you who are slightly more optimistic, perhaps, might be thinking, well, I'd really like to continue practicing. You know, the retreat's coming to an end, but I'd like to carry something of what I've been doing here forward into my everyday life. I don't want it all to just trickle away. And those of you who've done retreats before will have notice this phenomenon of coming on retreat, getting into the retreat routine after a few days, feeling, you know, relatively comfortable with getting up early, restricting the amount of food, not talking, that becomes something very pleasant, not doing the things that one usually does at home, and spending many hours in meditation, in the pujas and so on, just being in the company of, you know, people who are making similar efforts. And then at the end of the retreat, kind of considering how one would like to continue and setting up all kinds of plans, how one's going to continue one's practice. And the first couple of days actually feeling quite focused. One goes home, work situation, actually a sense of being able to cope maybe better than one had expected. a sense of actually being more collected, more patient, more tolerant, more accepting of others, less frantic, less agitated, less burnt out, and generally pretty good for the first couple of days. And then little by little, that sense of well-being, collectedness, composure, mindfulness, seems to dwindle. And we can feel a bit disappointed, a bit perplexed, and wonder whether it was really worth all that effort coming on retreat, just as bad as we were before. And this is something that I've certainly experienced in my own practice, in relation to retreats, also just in relation to my life, in lay life. I'd spend the weekends fairly quietly. I lived in a more or less on my own, so I could structure my days according to my own terms. So I used to actually do little pujas, and I'd sit and live in quite a reasonable way. And then I'd go into work on Monday, and I'd be feeling quite good and surrounded by people who perhaps had a different lifestyle. And by the end of the week, at the beginning of the week, I'd actually feel that I could actually, breathe some sense of calm into the office where I was working. Sort of, I'd notice people sort of, getting a bit calmer when we'd talk, and had a sense that I was actually, that my practice was supporting others in some way. And then the week would go by, and by the end of the week, I would be just as frazzled as everybody else. And so I used to wonder about this, and I was very interested in this fact of life, that the surroundings that we live in have an effect. The people that we associate with affect us. The things that we do in our lives has an effect. And there's no getting away from this. So during these days of retreat, there's been a chance to enable the mind to settle down. There's been a chance to just actually experience what it's like when we renounce, when we give up certain things, when we simplify our lives, to really experience the benefits of this. Obviously it hasn't just been a bundle of fun, because I know, having spoken with you all, that this, in addition to a feeling of increased collectedness and ease, there's also been that this inner relaxation has also allowed some quite difficult mind states to arise, to actually begin to allow things that have been kind of kept locked inside, locked into the unconscious or the subconscious, maybe for many years. Because we've relaxed, we've actually enabled some of these things to come into consciousness. So there's been a chance to release them, which, as I said at the beginning, is actually part of the work of a retreat, is to allow the things that we've never really acknowledged, or we, you know, that we've been frightened of or ashamed of or haven't been able to deal with at a conscious level. We just push them down, and so it's been like a chance to allow these things to release. So part of the well-being that we experience now is just like having allowed some things to go, you know, sort of some way lightened our burden, released quite a lot of energy. It takes quite a lot of energy to keep things pressed down and keep things under control. And having had an opportunity these days to liberate them, to let them out of control in a very safe way, you know, there's been no danger that we're going to go and murder anybody or have a temper tantrum, at least not externally. Maybe you've had your internal temper tantrums. I'm sure some of you have been through some quite significant moments of rage. It's happened in a very unharmful way. So that will also be contributing to this sense of well-being, just having released a lot of the things that we've been holding in different ways. So how can we continue our practice? How can we continue this inner work that we've been doing during these days? How can we use the structure of our life as it is, away from this particular retreat form? Are there things that we can do to adjust the way that we live, our lifestyle, that is perhaps more conducive, more supportive of calm and understanding, more conducive of actually more enabling the things that arise or that we meet to be processed then and there, rather than kind of just shoved down out of the way. And just because we don't have the space to really feel what we're feeling when we're feeling it, as it happens. And as I've said quite often, I think during this time, it's very much a do-it-yourself practice. So each one of us has a different character, different qualities, different things that we find easy, different things that we find extremely difficult, and, you know, a totally different way of practicing, really. And having set up quite a, you know, clear structure during this time, as the structure changes, like the retreat structure, this particular retreat structure ends, and you'll have a chance to evolve your own structure according to your own needs and aptitudes, inclinations. And I'd like to suggest that you really approach this challenge with interest and enthusiasm. And don't be too afraid of getting it wrong. Sometimes we can be rather timid in our practice. You know, sticking, like when, like part of the evolution of the nuns community, this is just an example of how we can be timid. Part of the evolutions of the nuns community was Like for the first years, we didn't really have any training. You know, we just kind of did what we thought and copied the monks, basically. Did the best we could. And then, after a while, there was a feeling that actually we needed a bit of training. But we weren't really in a position, we weren't able to train ourselves. You know, the group of nuns were, we were all equally inexperienced, and there was no way that any one of us could have kind of been the mother superior and laid down the law. I mean, the others just wouldn't have it. And none of us could have done that. So we were very fortunate that one of the monks was willing to step in and be like a kind of surrogate mother superior for us. And definitely was laid down the law, established all kinds of structures, which we still use, incredibly helpful, and established standards that we resisted vigorously. But fortunately, this was a monk of great determination and huge compassion, understanding, and so was able to hold steady in the midst of massive resistance until we were actually able to be trained and able to agree and to establish a training for ourselves. And the training that he suggested, we were able to make use of it, and so it got started. But then came the time when we had to let go of our mother superior and begin to make a whole load of mistakes. And that was extremely painful, extremely difficult. I mean, as long as we had Ajahn Sucitto there to rebel against, we were safe. it was very clear, and you know, we did what we were told eventually, and we didn't make very many mistakes, or very many obvious mistakes. But then, when he was no longer there, and we had to begin to learn about leadership and learn about living in a hierarchical structure within our own community, we spent quite a number of years just getting it wrong. I noticed myself a feeling of really not wanting to get it wrong. You know, I didn't want to make mistakes. I wanted to get it right. And so there was quite a lot of fear, I suppose, fear of making mistakes. And so for the first few years, we were very rigid in the way that we practiced, in the way that we lived in community, just because we were frightened of making mistakes. And the result was quite horrible, both for ourselves and also for the younger nuns who were sort of coming along. And the whole thing felt very it wasn't what you would call a lovely phenomenon. At least certainly not from the inside. It didn't feel particularly lovely, and so we made our mistakes, and I think the most important lesson that each of us learned, certainly for myself, the most important lesson that I learned was that actually I had to do it my way, that my way was best. Which, if you listen to that in one way, might sound incredibly arrogant. My way is best. But we can only do it our way. We use the basic principles, the basic guidelines, the Buddha's teachings, which are very, very broad, actually, when you pick them up and use them and investigate what they really mean for us. It's a very huge container, the Buddhasasana, the sort of organism, the Buddha Dhamma Sangha vehicle. It's vast, and there's space for everybody. Anybody who wishes to free the heart, anybody who is willing to put forth effort to practice, to be mindful, to take an interest and to study carefully the suffering that they experience in their life, to be able to be willing to take responsibility for it, rather than blaming everybody else or blaming the situation that we find ourselves in. Being willing to really contemplate dukkha until it's fully understood. So anybody who's willing to do that can liberate the heart from dukkha. Using the structure of the precepts that are like a protection. They're like a very, very good friend, just there at our elbow, just to remind us, don't do that. That's going to hurt. That's going to stop you. That's going to delay the process of liberation. It's not going to be helpful. It's not going to help you on your path. It's not going to help you on your journey. Better not to do that. So just using these guidelines in our daily life. They sound simple enough. You know, five precepts, you know, compared with like Bhikkhu Patimokkha, they have 227 precepts. And bhikkhunis have even more. How many do you have? 311. Sister Santachita has 311 precepts. And five precepts. Well, so what? It's hardly worth bothering about, really, is it? But if you pick them up and really take an interest in applying them in your own situation, in your own daily life, you'll find that over and over again there'll be a chance to actually see how they work, how they protect us. There'll be a chance to see, because one of the interesting things that happens as we practice, as we meditate, is that we become more sensitive, more aware of the effect of our speech and action. So, you know, at first, okay, we avoid killing people. That's a good thing to do. We avoid, you know, deliberately stealing, you know, robbing banks and shoplifting and smuggling. Things like that. We avoid being terribly promiscuous. We avoid deliberately telling gross untruths, or using speech to cause division, to cause dissension. We avoid getting totally plastered every Friday night or Saturday night, whenever it is that people get totally plastered. We avoid those things. But then, as we practice, as we meditate, we become much more attuned, as I said, to the effect of our speech and behavior, our actions. And it becomes much more difficult to even cause the slightest harm to anyone else or any creature, which can be a little bit awkward sometimes when you're with people who maybe haven't this same understanding, the same training. I find I get really, it really hurts me if people start swatting flies or talk about what they're going to do to the slugs in their garden. I find it quite difficult when people do these things, just because, of the way that the practice seems to work. One becomes very careful about taking things that don't belong, and so on. So the practice, just the precepts themselves, help us to contain those energies. So it's not that we don't sometimes feel that we want to cause harm, or to be careless about, whether something's really, we're really entitled to something or not. Sometimes we do want to do these things. Sometimes we don't want to be bothered to go through the proper channels and all of that. So this is a way of just reflecting on how we use the precepts as a guide, as a good friend. When one of the monks in the time of the Buddha complained about the number of precepts that he had, the number of training rules, I think by that time they got up to about 150. Because, some of you may know that the rules were actually made only when somebody did something wrong. So at first they didn't have any rules, because all of the people who came to be bhikkhus or bhikkhunis, they were all kind of pretty well perfectly enlightened already. They came for the right reasons, because they wanted to train and they understood the training. But then gradually people came along who perhaps didn't have quite the right understanding or motivation, and who actually needed some training and some guidance. And so gradually, as people complained, some monk would do something utterly outrageous, and the other monks, the virtuous monks, would go to the Buddha and they'd say, "Lord, this is happening." And the Buddha would go and say, "Venerable, is it true that you've done this or said this?" And the monk would say, "Yes, Lord." And then the Buddha would reprimand him or her and make a training rule. So by this time there were about 150, and this monk, who maybe was not quite as bright as some of the others, said, I'm completely perplexed by all these training rules. I can't possibly remember them all. How on earth do you expect me to know all these rules and to train in this way?" And the Buddha said, "Okay, well, can you manage three?" And Mark said, "Well, yes, I think I could manage three." And so he said, "Well, there's a training in the higher virtue, which is like the five precepts, training in the higher concentration, like samadhi, He said, okay, training in the higher wisdom or higher understanding. Okay, I can train with these. So I talked about precepts, the training in the higher virtue. Let's think about higher samadhi as we can use it in our daily life. And samadhi, as I said, actually just means being collected. It's actually just being present, just bringing the awareness into the present moment. Now, some people might say, well, you know, when everything's pulling me in all directions, how can I possibly be collected? You know, sometimes it seems very, very difficult, and, you know, particularly for those of you who have very demanding jobs or confusing and complex family situations and relationships, you know, many, many demands, many conflicting demands, you know, real concern obviously for people's welfare, like if you have, you know, kids, you know, children, or, you know, elderly parents or husband or wife that you're concerned about, or really good friends that you want to support and help, or, you know, if you people at work that you, you know, care about, and your responsibilities, your duties, you know, it can all seem completely overwhelming. You might kind of, when we chant the Buddha's words on loving kindness, you know, you might hear this phrase, unburdened with duties. You know, this is what should be done. You know, be able and upright, something and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, unburdened with duties. I think, my goodness, I've got so many duties. How can I possibly get rid of them all so I'm not burdened with them? So I don't have duties to be burdened with. It can seem, you know, ridiculous. But I always reflect on this one in two ways. One is to actually consider the duties that you have, and it may be that you're carrying a few more duties than you need. There might be a few duties that you can unburden yourself of. We can actually pick up duties as a kind of, in a kind of compulsive way, kind of almost as a kind of a way of like filling out our sense of self. I can. You know, it's lovely to be useful, isn't it? It's wonderful to be needed, and to be, you know, the one person who can possibly do this job, this thing. It certainly happens in our community. I mean, it's something I've done. Really lovely to pick up duties and to do things that are useful. But one of the things I've started in the last year or two or three is cultivating the practice of saying no, and also cultivating the practice of not saying yes too quickly. So somebody comes along and says, oh, sister, could you do this? Or you're in a meeting and, you know, there's one of those awkward silences when, you know, people say, well, we need somebody to do this, and everybody goes rather quiet. So what do you do? I used to compulsively stick up my hand straight away and said, oh, I can do it. Oh, I can do it. Oh, yes, I'll do it. You know, and in your mind you can do it. You know, you can, in your mind you can do it very easily. You can do everything in 2 seconds. But then, you know, the meeting's over and you start doing it. And of course it takes longer. It always takes longer. Everything always takes longer than you think. So to just consider, there are certain situations where perhaps you don't have to be the one that does it. Or if somebody asks you if you can do it, you know, you can feel a sense of I mean, maybe you feel a sense of, you know, pleasure that somebody thinks that you're just the one for the job. It's quite nice when people think that or approach you in that way. But maybe to learn how to say things like, let me think about it. That's a very useful phrase. Let me think about it. I'll let you know in a couple of days, or I'll let you know, or when do you need to know? And just actually to consider, you know, is it really important that I do this? And if it is, then is there something else that I can not do to give myself, so that I've got the time and the energy to do this particular job? So that's one way of, like, being a little bit less burdened with duties, to actually consider carefully before you pick up duties, and to consider carefully, if you do seem to have an awful lot on your plate, well, is there some way that I can actually simplify and do a little bit less? The other way that I've found great is just to not carry your duties around as a burden. So there may actually be many things that you need to attend to. But actually you can only attend to one of them at a time. So when you're not attending to a particular duty, then you don't have to carry it. You know, sometimes we can get into a sort of mind state of, you know, I've got all these things to do. You know, I've got so much to do, and I haven't got any time. You know, I haven't got nearly enough time to do it, and I've got to do all these things. And these people, you know, they've got no idea how much I've got to do. They don't understand. They keep asking me to do more and more, and I'm just never going to manage. You know, and you're walking around the place with this great sort of burden of duty on your head or on your shoulders, and you add on to that the burden of resentment, which is even worse. You're feeling really resentful and upset about having all these duties. So we've been practicing walking meditation now for just over a week, and hopefully we've learnt how to bring the awareness into the present with the feet touching the ground, to recognise the kind of magnetic quality of the brain or the mind, to sort of suck up these thoughts and concerns, but to counteract that, to really deliberately bring the awareness out of the head and into the feet. We've learned how to bring the awareness into the body as we're sitting, to turn the attention to the breath, just as a way of putting down the burden. So this is quite a fun thing to experiment with, and it may not, in fact I'm quite sure it won't be possible for it to be like a continuous experience of being totally unburdened with duties, because sometimes if we're anxious about a particular task, you know, the mind does tend to pick it up and to become quite obsessed with it. But you can just experiment with some of the different tools of mindfulness that we've spoken about during these days, and just try out some of them and see which one works for you, so that you're not having the experience of being totally burdened, when actually there's no need to be carrying the burden. Our duty is to be happy, is to live life fully and completely, is to cultivate a sense of ease and well-being, is to notice the suffering that we experience in our lives and to take an interest in it in order to understand it, and to experiment with different ways of relinquishment. That's our duty, and it's a duty that we can carry lightly. So sometimes I hear people saying, oh, my practice, it's just terrible. You know, I can't meditate. I'm so greedy. I'm so awful. My practice is really terrible. I'm a hopeless case. And I've felt that myself a lot. So then we need to be very, very sharp with those kind of voices. That's Mara, you know, in case you in case you hadn't realized, that's Mara telling you how hopeless you are, creating this sense of a somebody who can't do it. So at that point you say, I know you, Mara. You say, who are you to tell me? Who are you to say all this? Touching the earth, like when Mara came along to the Buddha after he was enlightened and said, you're no good. You really think you're enlightened? He said, I call the earth to witness. So these kind of thoughts touch the earth. Establish the awareness in the present. I like to see the practice more like a craft or a skill or a game. You know, something that we can play at. That doesn't sound too irreverent. Something that's really interesting and fun. And sometimes people ask, you know, what about creativity? You know, for monks and nuns, we're not supposed to play music, we're not supposed to dance, we're not supposed to kind of, you know, have plays or do theatrical performances or anything like that. And they say, well, what about creativity? You know, where does that come in? And what about beauty? Surely there must be something beautiful about, you know, can you not kind of be creative? Can you not make beautiful things? And my sense is that actually the practice, living the life, the Dhamma, is the most beautiful thing that you can do in your life, the most creative thing. Because it's something that, as a human being, we can intimately involve ourselves with, that's continuously stimulating and challenging. And for each one of us, it's different. So, you know, the teaching is actually the same for all of us, anicca, dukkha, anatta, the three refuges, the four noble truths. But the way that we actually implement that, the way that we apply it in our lives, is unique. You know, so Ajahn Sumedho, he's always talking about just trusting your own intuition, trusting your own wisdom, your own understanding, your own experience. Just trying out, seeing what works for you. So I've talked a little bit about sort of general mindfulness. I've talked a little bit about some of the pitfalls, the sort of sense of being overwhelmed and completely overburdened with responsibilities and duties and ways of just trying to put that sense down, trying to kind of create a space in our lives. You know, so that there are moments when the mind is quite empty, just looking at a sunset. It was lovely the other evening when we were practicing outside and just, you know, it was the walking practice and just seeing that, you know, half a dozen of you had just sort of stopped, just looking at the sunset. And it's just wonderful to see you doing that. And just, I just hope you'll do lots more of it. And just sort of sitting on a bench, watching the light change is another wonderful occupation. Or listening to the birds. Like, have you ever really listened to the dawn chorus or the evening time? Just hearing the bird sounds and the way that they seem to kind of echo each other. Have you ever wondered what the birds are saying? I remember somebody giving a talk and saying how, you know, we think the bird sound is so beautiful, this sort of lovely, lovely sound, and you watch them, they just open their beak and this sound comes out. And how do they do it? And somebody was saying, actually, probably what they're saying is, don't you come into my territory, this is my bit. Maybe not at all beautiful, but anyway, as human beings, we can project what we like onto their beautiful songs. So these kind of pursuits, hugging trees, we've already talked about hugging trees, lying on the earth, just really feeling the earth supporting you, and just taking time to do that from time to time, you know, particularly when it's warm like this. And just these ways of really kind of indulging in a totally allowable way in the beauty of human existence. Other things that people have been asking about is just like having a shrine or doing some kind of pujas, you know, in daily life. You know, what about that? And you know, this is something you can certainly experiment with. You're just finding out what works for you, what's suitable for your situation. You know, so those of you who live on your own, you know, you can do whatever you like. You can have a whole shrine room, make a big shrine, have candles, incense, flowers, do bowing, do chanting, meditate, whenever you like. Those of you whose lifestyle doesn't allow for that, you could just have a quiet place where you sit, you know, where you practice meditation. Just take a little bit of the chanting to do, or even just saying something like, you know, to the Buddha I go for refuge, to the Dhamma I go for refuge, to the Sangha I go for refuge, or Namo Tassa, just saying that three times. You know, there's a whole range of different things that you can try, or others of you may not want to do any of that, and that's perfectly fine too. What I would suggest, however, is to try to have little reminders, or big reminders, just things that can help you to remember. You know, in the monastery we have like Buddha rupas and shrines and pictures of teachers and so on. The Sangha, I won't say that. Well, the Sangha calendar, for example, with quotations and things. So things, just consider, you know, having something like that, just like a Buddha figure, or those of you who are not particularly Buddhist, you know, like some people, you know, if you have a Christian background, like have a crucifix, or just something to help you to remember the potential for liberation. Remember the spiritual path. I have a picture of two pictures of like whirling dervishes, because for me that's a very powerful image, you know, just somebody receiving blessings from above and spreading them, bestowing blessings. I just really love that sort of symbol of the still point, turning around the still point. That presence in the earth, in the world. So whatever reminds you, and as much of it as possible, I would suggest to set aside time for meditation. It doesn't have to be a huge amount of time, but try to make it regular. Try to do it every day. set yourself a time that works well with your routine, so it's not a huge struggle that you fail at after the first couple of days. So, you know, consider carefully what's appropriate for my particular situation. Coming to the monastery whenever you can, if you live close by. You know, if you live close to one of the other monasteries, going there and spending time in the shrine room or the temple. If you have an opportunity to meet with monks or nuns, and just spend time with them. You know, come at tea time or come and stay for a few days. If you don't live near a monastery, try to get together with other people to practice meditation in a group. There are many groups over the country, and there'll be a list pinned up so you can contact people who practice regularly together. The Buddha spoke about the blessings of association with the wise, associating with people who are wise, whether they're Buddhist or Christian or Hindu or Jewish or whatever the tradition, people who have an understanding of life and an interest in living life skillfully. And just really to treasure that kind of friendship, that kind of companionship. It is a treasure. Being that for others, not in a kind of prudish, I'm going to tell you where it's at kind of way, but just a gentle friend who can support and help those that one loves to avoid foolishness and avoid doing things that are going to cause themselves harm or cause harm to others, get themselves into trouble. That's what we do for each other in the Sangha. It's quite it's very human when you look into the training that we have. There's a section on the duties of a teacher to their disciples and duties of the disciples to the teacher. And the teacher is supposed to give guidance to the disciples and make sure that they have what they need, that they have a bowl and they have robes. Look after them or make sure that they're properly looked after if they get sick, these kind of things. And then the duties of the pupil to the teacher are to look after them as they get sick, and also to encourage them if they seem to be getting a bit discouraged about their practice. And if they don't feel able to do it, then making sure that somebody else can offer them a bit of support and encouragement, and even take them on a little outing if they seem to be getting a bit down. And I just really like that it's not, that we all of us, need help at different times. I was talking to somebody the other day about how the sort of feeling of actually always being on the receiving end, that they just seem to need an awful lot of help. And I said, well, okay, right now you need help, but there'll probably be a time when you're in a position you can offer help to somebody else. And that's how it seems to work. And it can be quite humiliating if you kind of like to be the one who's always helping, and then suddenly you find that you need help and have to ask for somebody to help you or accept someone's help. But one of the beauties of this human existence is that we can both giving, being able to give help, and also just being able to receive Sometimes we only want to give, and it can be quite difficult to receive. And like Western training seems to be very much about being self-sufficient, and I don't need anything from you, thank you very much. I can manage, I'm all right, everything's fine. And sometimes it's actually very nice just to say, well, actually I'm really struggling right now, and yes, I would appreciate a bit of help with that. And being able to offer help is very nice too. So just, it's like the flow, you know, it's not just a one-way thing, but just this sort of cycling of, I mean, maybe you could call it love, just caring and loving each other, looking after each other. It just makes life into something very, very beautiful. This is the kind of subject I could actually talk about for probably another 2 or 3 hours. And I'd intended to give a short talk, but I've given a long talk. So maybe that's enough for you to chew on. And so I think I'd like to end there. And there'll be a chance for me to say a few more things tomorrow. And then that'll be it. And I have to say, it's been a very nice time for me. I've enjoyed this retreat, in spite of it being a bit hotter than I would have chosen. And I really hope that you've enjoyed a lot of it as well, and that the unbearable bits haven't been too unbearable, and that you will be able to find a way to actually enjoy continuing your practice in a different environment, with a different structure, when you go away from here tomorrow. Avon. Mm-hmm.